If you could ask God one question, what would it be? It's the opening line to that Christianity Explored course Rico was mentioning earlier, and it's a good one. There's a Middle Eastern proverb which runs like this: it's more difficult to ask a good question than to give a good answer. That's a challenging thought, isn't it? So if you could ask God one question, then what would it be? If you could say one thing to God, what would it be? You see, this incident revolves around someone who gets his chance to say his one thing to Jesus. I don't know what yours was, but he went for verse 13. Someone in the crowd said, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Don't know about you, but it feels a bit of a come down to me. You know, it takes you back to the school playground, doesn't it? Those petty sibling squabbles. You know, it's not fair, it's my turn. It feels even more of a come down when you see its setting, because Jesus has spent the first bit of this chapter speaking about a future world, and it's a remarkable one. It's a different world. Just look at verse 2. Now, there is nothing concealed that will not be disclosed. There's an uncomfortable thought. You know, you might get away with it now, but it will come out then. Here's a world where there's nothing for gossips to pass on. Have you thought of that? Because everything's public knowledge already. That's an unsettling idea. It's an important world, though. If Jesus is to be believed, the person who really matters in your life and mine is not the one who can end our life in this world, but the one who decides our future in the next. And look at verse 4. "I tell you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body and then can do no more. But I'll show you who you should fear. Fear him who, after your body has been killed, has authority to throw you into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him." It's a connected world as well. How we respond to Jesus in this world determines our future in the next. According to him, look at verse 8. "I tell you, whoever publicly acknowledges me before others, the Son of Man, Jesus, will also acknowledge before the angels of God. But whoever disowns me before others will be disowned before the angels of God." Now, I don't know about you, but there are plenty of things I want to ask or say about pretty much all of that. And yet that's the moment when the hand goes up in the crowd and the man seizes his 15 seconds of fame to say, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Sounds even more hollow and trivial than when I first heard it. I mean, had he been listening to a word Jesus was saying? Or was he the kind of ultimate pragmatist saying, "Forget your fantasy world, get your feet back on the ground, Jesus. This is a recession. Tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Well, whichever, Jesus is reluctant to go there. He speaks as if he hasn't come to settle every squabble. We've got the tools to do that ourselves. But look what he says in verse 14. Jesus replied, "Man, who appointed me a judge or arbiter between you?" He's not going to be sucked into the fight. But he does give a warning. It's there in verse 15. "Then he said to them, 'Watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed.'" Now, we live in a society here where we love to label and demonize. It's a great way of, as long as we're not one of the ones that get labeled, of putting all the blame on them and not us. But you notice, you don't have to be a banker with an enormous bonus to be greedy. You can be at the other end of the scale, being unjustly done out of an inheritance that might rightly be yours. And that sense of righteous indignation might just be masking a heart of greed. Never satisfied till it's got more. Imagining things are the answer. So Jesus goes on, "Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions." Now there's a bit of us that knows that, isn't there? We speak of the value of friendships and relationships. We talk of job satisfaction. Even the government tries to measure and target happiness. Yet this is deeply countercultural. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. But there's so much in our culture, and not just adverts, that screams at us that this thing or that thing would save time. I mean, we'd be free, have made it. And Jesus says, things can narrow life. Can mean I've missed it. And imagine hearing this in a developing world culture where your inheritance was your hope. And materially, your life might depend on getting your fair share. It's as if Jesus knows how hard it is to hear his point. So he tells a story. Not to address the presenting issue, the inheritance, but to address the heart issue, the greed and the possessions. And actually the story, it's not anti-wealth or even anti-wealth creation, though its warning is more articulate than ever Occupy London appeared to manage. The story is about a wealthy farmer. But it could just as easily have been a city story about a lawyer or an accountant or even a public sector worker. And it's all the more disturbing because at first sight, he's not as crass a materialist as we might have been expecting. I mean, look, he's got all the marks of success. He's wealthy. Verse 16. He told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. Now, farmers can be wealthy. Now, I've never met one who isn't complaining about the weather. It's either, you know, too hot, too cold, too wet, too dry. But I've certainly met a handful that have an impressive handful of cars in their garages. Yeah, they can pull it off. Here's the man, he's just one of hundreds on the 7:32 commuter train from Penge each morning, heading for the West End, reading his Financial Times. And if you were next to someone in the know, they might just nudge you and point him out and whisper, he's made a killing. He's no fool. He's wealthy and he's careful. I mean, look at verse 17. He thought to himself, what shall I do? I've no place to store my crops. And then he said, this is what I do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I'll store my surplus grain. He worked out how to handle the unexpected profits so that the tax man didn't take them all. Store his grain mountain so as not to flood the market. Build his bigger barns before the chancellor imposed some new stamp duty. He sank his profits into the business. Invest to grow. He's as sharp as any accountant. Waste not, want not, as his mother used to say. Yeah, no point in being stupid. And he did something else. He planned ahead. I look at verse 19. I'll say to myself, you've plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, be merry. Take life easy. It is almost out of character, isn't it? If you're rich and successful, it can be very hard to let go. But for him, life is not so narrow, it's not so limited to the treadmill, that he can never get off. And he's determined to enjoy his retirement. The Sunday Times magazine ran an article on him, The Man Who Knew When to Stop. Joe Smith, who'd long since backed out of the rat race, read it in his armchair and thought, how wise. And yet the story is not told because he's a success or wise, but because he makes some of the biggest mistakes you can make in life. Now, he may have all the marks of success, but he actually makes the mistakes of a fool. And verse 20 hits you out of the blue, doesn't it? Brutally so. The retirement party is just ending. The whiskey glass is still in his hand. The holiday brochures are on the coffee table. And the heart stops. He's dead. He's gone. That's it. All over. Now, they have the memorial service a few weeks later in church, and the eulogies come, and the chairman of the company stands up and says how he was a pillar of the firm, a leading light in the profession. The family member gets up and speaks of him as a loving husband and a devoted father. And God sends a wreath with just two words on the card, you fool. He's made three of the biggest mistakes you can possibly make in life. See, here's the first. He mistook himself for God. I mean, look again at verses 18 and 19. Listen to the planning meeting. See who's at the center of it all. This is what I'll do, he says. I will tear down my barns and I will build bigger ones, and there I'll store my surplus grain, and I'll say to myself. See, 7 or 8 times he speaks of I, my, myself, as if he imagined that because he thought of something, it happened. Because he wanted something, he got it. The psalmist said, the fool has said in his heart, in his decision-making, there is no God. We've no idea what the farmer's church-going habits were, but functionally, he was an atheist and a fool. He mistook himself for God. Second mistake he made, he mistook time for eternity. See what he says, verse 19, I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Yes, and then? And then? He keeps talking of my barns and my grain, but he forgets they're on a short-term loan from God. He makes the mistake so many of us make. We imagine we're owners. But we, just like him, will find we are owned. But God said to him, verse 20, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. And when you haven't come to terms with that, it's devastating. Look, in my job, I get to meet people who face that moment right up. I remember once going to meet a widow and her husband had died less than a couple of hours previously. He got up that morning, still in his pajamas, just collapsed back on the bed, dead. No warning, no inkling, no sign of it. You can imagine, I'm there 90 minutes or so later. The grief is still red raw. I'd never met her before, but in her anguish, she began to pour out their story. How they'd been saving and saving to buy this bed and breakfast, which is where we were and where they lived, and this was the last stop in their working career together, and they were going to make a go of this, and they hoped to save up in the next 6 or 7 years, and then they got their retirement plans already out in the countryside, and they were in ruins. She forgot none of us are God to control those kind of plans. This very night your life will be demanded of you, and then who will get what you prepared for yourself? No succession planning. This farmer's children left to squabble over the will. All that preparation and planning for time. Not a thought for eternity. What a mark of a fool. He mistook himself for God. He mistook time for eternity. He mistook his body for his soul. See, verse 19, I'll say to myself, and there's a word in there in the original that you could translate, soul. You have plenty of goods laid up for many years. He'd provided actually everything he could possibly want for his body. Eat, drink, be merry. And found himself where he couldn't access that account. This very night, your life, it's the same word as is there in the verse before. It means more than soul, but it includes it, all of you. Your life will be demanded of you. And the only account he can now access has nothing in it. Do you see verse 21? This is how it'll be with whoever stores up things for themselves, but is not rich towards God. The only account available, and it's empty. Now please, get this, the scriptures understand the unexpected surplus, the banker's bonus. They don't vilify them. They just make it clear that the righteous, the godly person, thanks God and gives to the needy. This fool forgot God and hoarded for himself. He sapped his soul, he shriveled his life, he mistook his body for his soul. What a fool to make those mistakes. What a fool to turn a success into a failure. At the heart of this story, the man of success meets his moment of truth and is declared to be a fool. But Jesus tells the story so that you and I face our moment of truth in advance. I mean, verse 20 is told as a warning. That's why it is so brutal. It's meant to get under my skin, and it's meant to get under your skin. It's meant to stop me making the same mistakes, whether I've got those riches already or just dream of having them. It's told to turn a fool into a success, if you like. I mean, look at the warning again. Notice this. Notice what cannot be changed. Verse 20. This very night, your life will be demanded from you. You know, one day, God is going to say that to you. One day, God will say it to me. Your life is demanded from you. None of us can escape that moment. Fabrice Muamba's collapse on the football pitch last week has reminded us how unexpected and dramatically sudden it might be. Others seem to close their eyes to the very expected and inevitable. I read an article in the newspaper last week about Butlin's holiday camps and how successful they've been in recent years. And the three owners of Born Leisure, the company that runs them, are 67, 77, and 79. They remain, the article says, committed to the business. They attend board meetings. They're consulted on key decisions. What will happen when they're no longer around remains unclear. The man who is Bourne's chief executive in everything but name says it hasn't come up because, quote, in their minds, they'll be here in 10, 15 years. They're 67, 77, 79. And they're thinking, we'll be here in 10, 15 years. So the chief executive goes on, they're not thinking about succession. That's the only way to live. No, it's not. It's a stupid way to live. I mean, no one has cracked life and ignored this reality, their death. Only a fool would think he had. What cannot be changed? Your life will be demanded from you. What can be changed? God's verdict. You fool. Now, it's not said with a note of sadistic glee. That may be in some preachers' hearts, but it's not in God's. His is full of grace and truth. This story is a shout of warning, and love shouts if it needs to. It doesn't just soothe. Jesus told this story so that he might never need to pass that verdict on you or on me. Jesus came into this world so that he might never need to pass that verdict on you or on me. Jesus went to the cross so that whatever mistakes we've made, whatever follies we've been caught up in, could be dealt with, forgiven, borne away. Originally said, you remember when he and his wife came to the UK? It was a chance to redefine our life. Well, Jesus told this story so that we might have a chance to redefine our life and realize what can be changed, the verdict, you fool. But only if this happens, what must be changed is changed. And what must be changed is not rich towards God. It's the one bank account that ultimately matters, and it can't afford to remain empty, and it doesn't need to stay empty, and it doesn't require shrewd business skills to change it, just the humility to face God empty and thankful now. To acknowledge the Jesus who longs to and is able to make you rich then and not disown you. If you want to know more of what it means to be rich towards God, well, I can't think of anything better than just to fill in that contact slip and come along to that 2-week Christianity Explored Express course. But let me end with this story. The American author Mark Twain, he was touring Europe with his young daughter once, and everywhere royalty, well-known artists, scientists honored him. Wherever he went, he had the full red carpet treatment. And near the end of the journey, his daughter said, Papa, you know everyone except God, don't you? Yeah, I thought it was funny at first, but actually it isn't if you think about it. It's very painful. That is the mark of the ultimate fool. This is how it'll be with whoever stores up things for themselves but is not rich towards God. It'd be good to pray that isn't us, wouldn't it? Why don't we do that now? Lord, thank you for the love that warns us. Forgive us for the folly of building our lives around things and success of any shape or kind. Give us the humility to be rich towards you and draw us to the Jesus who can make us so. For his name's sake, Amen.